And in that way, I avoid talking about ID characteristics at all. Instead, I have merely circumstances which causally account for the behavior. It will fit the formula. If you produce this circumstance and this, you'll get this behavior. Now, this is fine in reconstruction, because if you introduce an ID characteristic, indeed, you refer it back to the prior history, and whatever you pick as the prior history that accounts for this, Skinner would pick as the prior history that's part of the causal account of the behavior. That's only in reconstruction. If you try it at this time, you say, look, I'm going to show you, I'm going to generate that behavior by producing this and then later this. What you find out is it often doesn't work. Why? Because the occurrence of this does not guarantee that you get that. And since it doesn't guarantee that you get that, it will also not guarantee that in these circumstances you'll get that behavior.
I got confused just then. The link from the prior history to ID characteristics is causal.
Yeah.
There. So if you had a prior history, you'd have to have the ID characteristic.
No. It's causal but not deterministic. That, in fact, for an individual of the right kind, this history will produce that ID characteristic. This history will produce that ID characteristic. But it doesn't follow that anybody who has this history will have an ID characteristic, because the effect of the history will depend on the prior ID characteristic.
Is it deterministic, though, assuming that you've got the prior ID characteristic?
Yeah.
Okay, that's...
Well, it's... No. It's deterministic in the sense of being a tautology. But this is not a causal account at all. It's a schema that you can use in giving a causal account.
Just for any ID characteristic, there will be a prior ID history. Okay, it's got to be...
Yeah. If you got here, there must have been some way that you got here.
Okay.
So that's why I say that working it backward, it's a tautology all the way, along the lines of, if you got here, there must have been some history whereby you got here, and for that history to have gotten you there, you had to have started from the right place. And so if it has already happened and I've done this reconstruction, you can simply use my reconstruction to pick out the relevant history and then deal with that causally. That's after the fact. If you're dealing with it before the fact, our knowledge of these things is not foolproof. And if I specify a history that I think is relevant, it may not be relevant. So you can say, in principle, whenever you can give this kind of explanation, you can give this kind. And therefore, you don't have to talk about ID characteristics. Because you simply short-circuited this two-stage link with a one-stage link.
Okay, and by doing that, Skinner...
preserves a completely causal account. Well, for Skinner, it's deterministic. Here,
it is causal.
This is causal. This is not.
But Skinner said that if you have two individuals, put them, they have a similar history, and put them in the same circumstances of condition. Get the same behavior. Would you say that? If so, is that because he doesn't observe?
No, only if they're similar enough. If the histories are similar enough, but then it's a tautology.
was wondering.
Because there's no way to know how similar is similar enough. Any more than there's a direct way of knowing which ID characteristics give you a given capacity. You can say in general, you have the capacities you have because you have the ID characteristics you have. We don't have a precise way of coordinating so as to say, if you have these ID characteristics, here's the capacity you have.
And that's why Spears formulation doesn't work sometimes, because you can't specify it. You can't do it.
So if we knew that kind of thing, you wouldn't need the cause effect account there to be able to predict. Anybody using any system could predict. So again, part of the moral is that predictions are not built into any of these systems. What the systems give you are schemas for plugging in information that you have. But the schemas do not themselves contain any information. They don't tell you what the world is like. And they certainly don't predict anything.
I'm not sure what kind of information you can tell Scary
Because there's no information you couldn't plug into this, and there's no information that you couldn't plug into this. The fact that you can plug everything into a thing doesn't mean that it's all informed. It can be as trivial as this. Remember I said that the relevant dimension is how much work you have to do on your own and how much the system does for you. This kind of system does zero for you. But you can plug everything into it. There is nothing that you can't characterize in one or another of those ways. And there isn't anything that people do that you couldn't talk about as a conditioned operant or as a case of shape and behavior.
So the question that the development scheme is easy.
Yeah, because there is no kind that is excluded. And there's no fact here, no possible fact that's excluded. And I hope it is quite clear here that this is uninformed. Whereas most theorists will think of their theories as informative to some extent or another.
What's the difference between not excluding effects and being able to plug in information as well?
This kind of thing gives you no notion as to what you could plug in. It could be anything. This kind of thing gives you no notion as to what you might plug in. This kind of schema gives you a lot more notion of what's going on and what you would be doing if you plug something in, what it would be doing for you. Tells you explicitly you're giving a historical explanation of the acquisition of an ID characteristic with no limits on the histories, the range of possibilities for ID characteristics, or of characterization of prior capacity. In that sense, there's nothing excluded, but there is structure built into this that goes beyond this or something as trivial as that. And in fact, it carries the form of the explanation. It's because various explanations have this form that they do explain. In that sense, this is like this thing shows you what is going on when you draw a particular conclusion given this structure. So the schema carries the explanatory force. This schema carries the explanatory force of particular things that exemplify.
Is Pairs a limit on let's see the entire informative value of that kind of schema in the operant condition to just what you've got? Because it seems like they usually call on another aspect of the system to make it informative, namely what you talked about last time where
what?
Okay, if you can attempt to identify the reinforcer, for that particular case, and you said it may work, it doesn't, you've got, you know.
Or something else.
And something else, but the fact is that sometimes it works.
Yeah.
And that's what they're finding informative about that form of explanation.
But are they? Again, there's a question of when you're using the thing, what's it doing for you? And is it doing more, any more for you than just saying, go try and see what works?
Well, if it works,
no, go try and produce the effect you want, and anything that works is okay. Wouldn't that license you to go on and do all of the various things that they do? Unless you're specifically going to use schedules of reinforcement or something of that sort that is part of the theory. There, as I said, you do have guidelines from the theory. You have precedents for trying different schedules of reinforcement, whereas without that background, you might never have thought of it. In that respect, the tradition is heuristic, but notice that schedules of reinforcement and their effects are not built into the theory. The effects are empirical findings. Well, look, you distinguish between the heuristic value and the informativeness of the theory per se versus the value of various empirical findings that were discovered by people who were using the theory. Because the value of those in no way depends on the theory once you have them. And once you have them, you then turn it over in your head and say, gee, anybody could have found those things out in terms of his theory. The findings are not peculiar to the theory. No findings are findings that you could only have found given a given theory. And it's easy to see why when you see that all of these theories are convertible into this. If they are, how could any finding be peculiar to one of those theories?
But if you're arguing the usefulness notion, it doesn't have to be the unique, you know, path to finding that information out to make it useful.
Yeah, but you have to ask yourself what it is that's useful. And what's useful is the findings, not the theory per se. And you could have had those findings without the theory.
Don't they go back to the issue, though, of if a particular way of ordering thinking of what, or your observations becomes a useful way? I mean, yeah, it should. It's what you find out that makes it useful. But if, I think the behavior modifier, for instance, would say it's this kind of technology that's useful in finding, you know, granted you may be able to find the empirical stuff out some other way, but doesn't it still make it useful that, you know, that this seems to be a pretty direct way of thinking?
Yeah, but being direct doesn't help unless there's some connection between that way of thinking and what you found out.
Okay, well, he's saying, for instance, yeah, everybody knew about bribery and, you know, blackmail and extortion for a long time.
Put Skinner to think of this again.
Right. But we're making a technology out of it.
Yeah. But as soon as you see it as bribery, extortion, and blackmail, you don't think of it as a technology. You think of it as tyranny. Because that's who has historically use those methods. It gives a new slant on the whole enterprise.
Well, they have a way of capturing those criticisms.
Remember, I said these are polemic descriptions. You can pick other less polemic characterizations. The polemics is simply a warning of what the unrestricted use of this kind of method would look like in a different frame of reference, namely a political one. And that, in turn, sensitizes you to that this isn't just technology.
The differentiation features. sent the first person to ride extraordinary black.
Well.
As opposed to a prison.
Somebody who gets bribed consents, okay.
But, well, then you're going to surrender. You're going to give me that.
Well, I wouldn't say that was the crucial thing, except when you're trying them and are assigning responsibility. But the main variable is how much pressure is it legitimate and what kind to put on a person. If you've got a rat in a cage, the kind of pressures that it's legitimate to put on him, there are different norms for that than what kind of pressures is it legitimate to put on prisoners in a jail, or citizens at large, or students in a classroom. And if you don't keep in mind this possible redescription of some of these behaviors on an experimenter's part, you may make some judgments that you or other people would regret. So even though those are polemic, there's some value to it. Okay, now, I've shown how you can dispense formally with ID notions by substituting the prior history and putting it in causal form. But one of the things that you want to, as critics of theories, be sensitive to is symmetry arguments. That very often, when there's a certain interesting move possible, there's also the inverse move. It's also possible. And here's a case in point, that you can use this arrangement and dispense entirely with a causal aspect and get yourself a completely non-causal theory by going directly from ID to ID and bypassing this. In both cases, it's a matter of leapfrogging and bypassing one of the elements in the diagram. Since you have this kind of arrangement, it is a sequential thing, you can indeed bypass this way, just as you can bypass this way.
Why do that? You said one ID characteristic leads to another ID characteristic.
The history, and specifically the causal aspect of the history. So you wind up saying it's ID characteristics that generate further ID characteristics, and in turn are generated by ID characteristics.
But isn't that kind of causal to say why it's generated by
ID? No, because ID characteristics do not explain causal. So if you have an explanation consisting of only ID characteristics explaining ID characteristics, it's not a causal explanation. What is it then?
Huh?
There are several ways of formulating. The most punchy way, I think, is self-actualization. Yourself at an earlier time creates yourself at a later time. Yourself at an earlier time brings out its own potential at a later time. Well, that's self-actualization. And self-actualization here is completely non-causal. You can see that they're completely symmetrical, that if one type of leapfrogging is okay, you can get away with the other type too. And the further implication then is that if you go to one or the other, it's not a function of the facts, it's strictly observer's choice. It's the ID characteristics of an observer that will account for is picking this one as against this one or vice versa, because the facts don't force it. The facts permit either one. And so we can say of Skinner's causal theory that since we know independently historically that Skinner wanted that kind of theory, and since we can see here the formal possibility of giving a completely historical account, at that point we say, so it's not surprising that Skinner's theory is a completely historical account. But as we'll see, and I'm anticipating here a little, we have another group, the existentialists, who explicitly want a non-historical account, and in fact give a non-historical account. And there too we say, since we already know independently that that's the kind of account they wanted, and since we can see here the formal possibility of giving that kind of account, it's no wonder that in fact they do give that kind of account. So once again, the historical aspect, the ID characteristics of the theorist, plays an important part in understanding how come the theory has the features that it does, given that it didn't have to. As usual, what we see is that every theorist has certain constraints on what he will accept as a legitimate theory. And his theory will be responsive to those constraints. So somebody who demands a causal theory, you'll have one. And what we've seen here is in what way a causal theory is workable, even with a phenomena that's not causal. We see also how a non-causal theory is workable, even with a phenomena that's causal. A peculiar arrangement like this to create such possibility. But there it is.
Well, that was sort of the problem they say it's working out sort of.
On my epitaph, they will say he wanted access to all the facts. None of this stuff was done with any of these theories in mind. All of the formulation was done in independent of the theory. I discovered empirically that all the theories reduced to it.
But whenever you present something, you take any possibilities as you possibly can at any one time. So that's what I think that's what you grew up in the line of the fact.
That's why
you take as many possibilities as you are.
That's the point that I said. I want access to all the facts, to all of the possibilities. And access to all of the possibilities is not a way of protecting yourself. Some possibilities are embarrassing. Possibilities are unpleasant or dangerous.
Yeah, but if you're explaining them, if you're an observer.
Think of that lion walking in that room. There's no way that you can make that a pleasant possibility. If you're going to have access to the facts, you have to take the good ones and the bad ones. Anyhow, as I say, you can see where, with this kind of scope, you can see how by choosing your language to take account of this structure, you can indeed talk causally or non-causally, and there won't be anything that you can't talk about that way. So you will pride yourself that you've shown that behavior really is caused, or you will pride yourself that you've shown that behavior really isn't caused.
I'm still not clear as to Skinner's giving basically an historical account of historic characteristics as cause. Whether he is his theory a causal theory? In certain respects, it seems very causal than presented in this notion in terms of.
No, but it's still causal because he says this and this cause that. This and this are the controlling variables. Or these are the controlling variables by virtue of this kind of conditioning. And the conditioning is a causal antecedent of that behavior. So he takes information and puts it in this form and does it explicitly and tells you why he wants to do it that way. There's very little doubt about what he's doing. The problem is to see how come he can get away with it the way that he does. Because normally you think that if something is an X and somebody goes around calling it a non-X, the facts will show him up. It's almost never the case. Here you can see why. If the facts will never show up a Skinnerian that there's something non-causal going on, and they will never show an existentialist that there's something causal going on. Why? Because if you stick to the theory, there is no way you can admit anything outside of it. If the theory has only cause-effect, there is no way you can admit something else. And if it won't admit cause-effect, there's no way that you can take that into account as something you found. In the long run, these kinds of examples ought to do something for you when somebody tells you that the point of doing research is to show that your theory is true. You can see that you can do research forever with these. Get all kinds of supporting evidence. And yet, you can look at both theories and say they're both wrong. So again, that's a digression, but keep that in mind in other settings where somebody is telling you in all seriousness that this is what science is, and then think of this kind of example, and you may break even.
Now, how long have you been talking about representational accuracy?
In part, I'm saying if you want to say explicitly what's involved, you need something than a tool that you can hit the phenomena over the head with. You need also a picture of yourself using that tool. That's part of what's going on. See, that's what I meant here. That what's contained in the theory leaves out all of this stuff that's required to make the theory usable in the way it is. And yet all of this stuff is also part of what's going on, and it's behavioral. And those kinds of behavior are in no way represented in our traditional theory. Instead, they're represented in philosophy of science or methodology or something else. So in psychology, you have two categories of behavior. One category, namely the behavior of experimenters and theorists, that you have a non-empirical philosophical theory of. And the other is the behavior of organisms that you have psychological theories to account for. And those two domains of behavior are never brought together.
You can represent behavior in a causal historical account, but that will be in principle inadequate in this.
No, because you're only taking into account this kind of link and not this. You see why this is essential, then you'll say somebody who doesn't even talk about it is leaving something out, even though there may be nothing that you could point to that you couldn't talk about. He's leaving out some facts.
Does it fair to say that, you know, behavior then involves an adequate representation of behavior falls back to both sorts.
Yep. Causal, not causal.
I understand that still, Skinner still is talking at a certain level about ID characteristics, not in your conceptions or your attitudes.
Well, yeah, he's talking about them, but he's not saying that. He's not admitting it.
Okay, but in terms of if he says...
See, as critics, we can say of him, sure he is, whether he admits it or not.
If this person
but
is.
He doesn't say he's doing that. We have to say that for him.
But that doesn't... But then he's still taking him into account. This person is acting in a certain way.
No, but the thing is, he's taking him into account and pretending he's not. That's why I said for him.
Does he deal with what is reinforced or divorced?
But that's informal. That's not part of the theory. There's no part of the theory that deals with what's reinforcing for different kinds of individuals. So where he'd have to have an individual difference notion. Those differences are over here as part of the methodology. In methodology, he says, you have to try, there are species difference, etc. But there's no part of operant conditioning theory that says, it's Skinner who says that. And that's like my giving you a pair of pliers and saying, look, you have to hold both ends, as you have to hold both handles. The fact that you have to hold both handles is not part of the plier. It's part of the directions that come with it. And the fact that you have to take individual differences into account is not part of Skinner's package. It's part of the directions that go with it.
Although you can explain those. By just referring to reinforcement history.
Sure. But if he admitted they were there, he could just go back to the reinforcement history and say, that's why you have those differences. And in fact, that's what we do this way.
Would you describe, rather just pointing to, again, to state what the, which hero is describing exactly what part of the package? So
this arrow is the causal arrow that connects history to ID acquisition. This arrow is the non-causal arrow that explains behavior as an expression of an ID characteristic, but not as quantified. Remember, in this parameter of intentional action is the way that you specify which ID characteristic a given behavior is an expression of. Whereas there's no place for specifying which event this behavior was caused by. Because to put it in that form requires an observer to select an option that's not built into the notion of behavior. Because it isn't, we can understand different behavior, different observers selecting different options. That's one of the things we get from the very notion of ID characteristics that are missing in this here. After all, in a deterministic world, there are no options. If you go that route, you don't face the problem of explaining how options are chosen among you.
Peter, is there any difference between history and the circumstances of the way you use it?
This history is more inclusive than just the circumstances, but it will include circumstances. This history includes the presence of other people and all kinds of things.
Well, that would be also circumstances.
Yeah. What I specify under circumstances are motivation and opportunity. You need to go one more notch if you elaborate opportunity, then you get all of these, because that's just circumstance in the usual sense of circumstance. Here I did this because I wanted to get at the parameters, some of the parameters. See, here it's not important what the circumstances are that provide the opportunity. It's only important that there is one. Here, the particular circumstances are important. Because here you're talking about learning history, not just opportunity for some behavior. You're talking about the learning history for a particular kind of learning. And so it isn't just an opportunity for behavior in general. It's an opportunity for a particular behavior. Basically, this part, this unit one, is reproduced every time you have a behavior in the history. Because this behavior is simply one of the behaviors in your history. So formally, whatever is here is kind of applicable at every, for every behavior.
That's why it seems so honest.
Yeah. Okay, how many of you read that clinical example? Is that all? Yeah.
First thing I see here is a reversal of the definitions of negative reinforcement and punishment. Okay.
We start with a battlefield situation where a soldier is on the battlefield and he's shot, he's wounded, he's in pain, and he's in danger. So think of a set of ingredients of that general sort. This is stretching it a little, but just for contrast. Because after being shot and wounded, he's taken to a hospital where he's taken care of. His pain is, if not eliminated, reduced, and he's not in any great danger. Type 3, he's sent back to the battlefield after he's been cured. Sent back to the battlefield, and lo and behold, he's got a paralyzed arm. And nobody can find any physiological basis for him to have a paralyzed arm. result, he goes back to the hospital. Where he is in. Once more, no pain, no danger. Okay, now the analysis is that the injury is an aversive stimulus, namely one the cessation of which is reinforcing. Because this is associated with this, being there will acquire negative reinforcing properties, being here will acquire positive reinforcing properties. Behavior was it that resulted in the sensation of pain? Presumably it was going to the hospital. Now, notice you have some choices there. You might pick getting your arm shot full of Novocaine, or you might pick leaving the battlefield. So it's not a given which description one picks to say is the behavior that was instrumental in relieving the pain and danger. But whichever one we pick as the one that did it, we will say that it is positively reinforced. So if we pick going to the hospital, then we say going to the hospital is behavior that was positively reinforced. What's the implication? Is that the likelihood of that behavior under similar circumstances will be increased. Again, remember the issue of how similar is similar. What are the dimensions that define similarity? So if we go to time three, we pick a description that visibly has some resemblance. Notice it doesn't have to be the same battleground, probably isn't. It doesn't have to look the same. It doesn't have to involve the same visual stimuli. What does it have to involve that's the same? Well, basically that. And if it involves this and none of these others, you'll get the result. And you could predict that it involved all of these and none of this, you wouldn't get the result. So now we plug this in here, having reminded ourselves of that, that if we're going to carry this account through, we need to describe the battlefield in these terms and not just in these terms. Now we say, in these circumstances, which are similar to those, he will engage in the kind of behavior that got reinforced then. What was that behavior? It's this. But notice the theory doesn't predict he will. It just says there's an increase in the likelihood of some such behavior under some such circumstance. And there might be an increase in the likelihood, and he doesn't go to the hospital. On the other hand, on the basis of the theoretical statement that says that under these conditions, the likelihood increases, You, as a predictor, might decide that it had increased enough to make you willing to predict that, in fact, it would occur. After the fact, when you know it has occurred, it's easy enough to go back and say, well, that was why. It is this reconstruction, then, will give you an account of why. Namely, that given this reinforcement of this behavior under these circumstances, that behavior in those circumstances is more likely, and those circumstances did indeed occur, and that behavior did indeed occur.
Something like, say 10 years later, he went back to the disease, the battlefield, and he had been cured, say, the prevalence went up. 10 years later, he goes back to the battlefield, and some hunters are behind him, and all of a sudden, he hears some shots, and he'll be able to predict some sort of effect from that.
I don't think anybody would predict it, but everybody could explain it once they knew it happened. Part of the reason why nobody would predict it is it doesn't happen that often. And everybody knows it. And given that knowledge, you'd be a fool to just predict it out of the clear blue sky. Knowing that might lead you to say, well, maybe that would happen. That is one of the possibilities. So it would remind you of that possibility. But you wouldn't. You'd lose money that way. Okay, now, all of this looks like a straightforward inference ticket type use of operant condition. What you use is one of the reinforcement patterns together with generalization to say, given this reinforcement, similar behavior in similar circumstances was not unexpected, and that's why it occurred. The interesting action comes here. Remember, this is what you started with. The observation that the guy has a paralyzed arm with no thing. This is part of your reconstruction of how it comes in heaven. And you look at this and you do something like the ID characteristics. You say, but why a paralyzed arm, considering A, that there are options, and B, that another individual wouldn't come up with a paralyzed arm? There are many pathways to leaving battlefields or getting into hospitals. It doesn't have to be this. Why this? And notice again what your task would be if you had to predict. If you got this far and said, we're going to take this guy back to the battlefield, would you really predict that he'd come up with a paralyzed arm? No. Because you know that 9/10 of the guys who do that just go back to the battlefield and don't have a paralyzed arm or anything else that gets them into the hospital. So why would you predict a paralyzed arm or any kind of symptom? So we turn the screw another notch. We say, okay, but now suppose you knew he had a symptom. Would you predict a paralyzed arm? Why not a paralyzed leg? Why not the neck? Why not a lower back pain? How come this? And you might settle for saying, well, that's irrelevant. Any way of getting up here is something that's to be expected. And it doesn't really matter which. And so we're not interested in accounting for which. Or you might try to account for why specifically that, or at least zero in on what kind of more particular behaviors it would be reasonable to expect. And that's what the further development of this example goes into. For example, what are some of the alternatives here? If the issue is that what he's going to do is leave the battlefield, notice, by the way, that we shifted now. Remember I said, we picked that he goes to the hospital. But we might have picked that he left the battlefield. We might have picked that he took a shot of Novocaine in the arm. At this point, we shift into the other description of why did he leave the battlefield. Because over here, we ask, what other ways were there for him to leave the battlefield? And the most obvious answer is he could have just left. He could have run away. Well, see, you have the second behavior option. This is the first, which would have been run away. And now you look at that and you plug it back into some wider context like this and say, but wait a minute, running away isn't that safe. After all, he wants to get himself out of danger. And running away will get him out of one danger, but it will only put him into another, which may even be more serious. Namely, all of the social consequences of deserting on the battlefield. And those can be serious. In fact, they can be fatal. Now, notice this is perfectly good ordinary reasoning, but not try to put it explicitly in operant conditioning form. How do you get this notion that there are social dangers involved in running away from the battlefield? What consequences? Remember, those consequences haven't occurred. They are merely consequences that he has to be aware of. You can't talk about his being aware of them.
Generalization.
Okay, now, is it plausible that he's had similar experiences of running away? Would you expect that somebody who deserts on the battlefield has, in fact, in other situations, run away?
He had a friend who deserted, and then there's a model.
You can't talk about modeling here either. No place for modeling in operant conditioning.
Okay, it's one we're talking about vendors.
Yeah, no, but that's why I'm saying that there's a perfectly obvious, normal kind of reasoning here. And I'm saying try doing that kind of reasoning using operant conditioning theory.
You couldn't say that there would be some particular escape from a battlefield. You could say there was a generalization from some other escape.
Yeah, but from what? Some other escape? Avoidance. Think of how many avoidance behaviors one engages in. Whenever one does something, one is avoiding something else. Which avoidance behavior, what kind of avoidance behavior in the past would account for this avoidance behavior now?
He wouldn't be around a big linebacker.
He's been eating from my strangers. And that's sufficient for it.
What has he? What?
If he's been threatened by his superiors, you get this army talk and stuff like that, you know. So the superior talks about what happens to people on the battlefield, you know, and they talk about you can be shot, especially if you're in Vietnam.
But why would listening to that kind of verbal behavior have this consequence?
Well, you talk about the, you know, social kinds of praise and social kinds of, you
know. No, but again, the trick is to... The trick is to put it in operant conditioning terms.
Okay, the secondary negative kind of reinforcement that came out when his commanding officer told him to comply. That's possible.
Well, remember, that's not a present stimulus.
How about him imagining himself running away and imagining the collapse and shot at from the front of the firing squad?
Well, I don't think it's Canarian. I think that other SR people, the desensitization type people, would talk about imagining as a response, but Skinnerian wouldn't.
Is that the same as self-reinforcement?
Yeah. Self-reinforcement of what? Or what would be the response that was self-reinforced? Not running? Kind of hard to think of not doing something as a response.
Do you have to have present terms of running away, or can?
Well, you can pick your description. You see, and it's crucial which description you pick.
Okay, if he knows, for instance, that
you can't talk about what he knows.
Okay.
Yeah, see, whatever description you give is going to appear again when you say he obviously was reinforced for doing something of that sort in other circumstances that were similar enough to this one. And so when you say of that sort refers back to how you describe his present behavior. And you can describe it as leaving the battlefield. You can describe it as deserting his comrades. You can describe it as breaking the military law. You can describe it as saving his neck. You can describe it as avoiding danger. It's up to you to describe the behavior first. Then you say, that kind of behavior was reinforced in the past. And now generalizes here.
You couldn't talk about returning to the safer location.
Well, if returning to a safer location is the behavior you described here. So you'd say, well, maybe what we better talk about here is violating an important social norm. And he probably has had experience that violating important social norms is followed by aversive stimuli. But therefore, in these circumstances, violating an important social norm is a behavior that has a low habit value, and so he's not going to emit that behavior.
Why is that allowed?
Because you've used the inference ticket this way, and you haven't, if you say he knew. Remember, the generalization schema gives you an inference ticket for explaining the occurrence of some behavior as generalization from a learning experience in which a similar behavior was reinforced. So if you want to explain the occurrence of this behavior, you have to say there was earlier a similar behavior which was reinforced in similar circumstances, and the similarity is great enough to explain the occurrence of this one in these circumstances. And that's the kind of explanation that the operant conditioning theory licenses you to give. It not only does not license you, it prohibits you from saying anything that has the form, he knew that X was the case. So you have to put it in the form that the theory licenses, and that's one of the forms that will do the job.
They're saying that there's nothing that's similar enough. All they do is come back to say that's why he has the airlines.
No, they say, well, sometimes these generalization gradients are tricky. You might be surprised what this is a generalization from. And indeed, you're right. But at least, you see, you have a way of staying within the confines of the theory and reconstructing an account of how come he has this. On the other hand, if you look at the nature of that reconstruction, how illuminating is it to be told that obviously the reason it has this is that there is some earlier behavior that's similar to this that was reinforced? Don't you already know that from the theory in general? What good does it do you in understanding his paralyzed arm? Unless you can go further and say, for example, which behaviors were reinforced that account for this? And would you expect to be in a position to give that kind of description if, for example, you were the battlefield psychologist and had to deal with it? No. It would be very hard, even if you had a complete case history, to decide which were the behaviors that got reinforced that account for this.
Alternative to talking about the generalization of avoiding social practices which were individual versus reinforcement would be to say previously, even though in the battlefield he was afraid and was in pain and he would have liked to have run away, what happened instead was by being shot, wounded, he was taken to the hospital.
So you can't say that he would like to have been taken. Yeah, but counterfactuals will not operate causally. counterfactuals will not operate causally. The fact that it would have been a relief for him, or it would have been reinforcing to him to do something, will not operate as a cause of his present behavior. Because it's not a fact. Possibilities can't cause anything.
But they speculate on what kinds of reinforcements would be reinforcing for this particular person, though.
Well,
talking like,
but something that reinforces is some state of affairs, not a mere possibility. See, possibilities can only operate in behavior if you know about them. If you know that there is such a possibility. But if you don't have access to it that way, you don't certainly don't have access to it causal. Possibilities don't cause things.
Maybe that they just haven't given us enough information of the example. That as a battlefield psychologist, we would know maybe that he was shot in the arm. And that would, or that this case history showed that every time he was in stressful situations, it all happened.
Honestly, you don't need any such history in order to understand how come he could have a paralyzed arm.
Right, but you were asking why particularly paralyzed. And there may, you know, I could think of situations
yeah.
where the behaviors.
Okay, but now what? If you didn't find something like that, would you then say the theory is false? Because that's what there had to be in order to have a paralyzed arm? So again, the theory isn't helping you by telling you what is the case. It simply opens up certain kind of possibilities. And there are certain possibilities that more obviously fit the generalization paradigm, and the perfect fit would be an identity between the earlier condition and the later, and between the earlier behavior and the later.
Doesn't the theory tell you to look for that kind of thing?
Well, it tells you to look for it, but you almost never find it. Because what you have are similarity, not identity, in the stimulus conditions, and similarity, not identity, in the response condition. And anything is going to be similar to a whole lot of things, not just one. And so there's a certain amount of arbitrariness and fudging in picking which things that you assign this as similar to, and therefore accounted for by. For example, a paralyzed arm, suppose you found that very often when he got in trouble, he socked people in the jaw with his arm. You say, gee, if that got reinforced, that's similar enough to a paralyzed arm, isn't it? Because, see, there's no limit to what might be similar that you might find. Well, see, what happens is, you say, how come he didn't do some of the other things we might have been? By the way, this thing on generalization, recall, is the equivalent of Allport's problem of functional equivalence of stimuli and equivalence of behaviors. It's the same issue that you've got a package and a package. Okay, so what we said was, well, we know he did this, how come he didn't do some of the other things that we might have expected? And one answer is, this one at least has gotten negatively conditioned earlier. Its likelihood is small because, if not literally this, at least similar other behaviors have been negatively reinforced. Therefore, any such behavior, for example, this one, is unlikely to occur. Therefore, whatever behavior occurs that is going to get him away from the battlefield and into a hospital, it's not going to be this, it's going to have to be something else if it's going to occur at all. And then if you went through the thing about why not a paralyzed leg, or you know, why not hysterical blindness or something else, you would have a very hard time making a case for why this and not something else. You probably would need a whole lot of additional facts to make any explanation even plausible. And then you ask yourself, well, what would you do with this guy? And you find out that what you would do with him in no way depends on this kind of reconstruction. You could have left it alone and you'd still do the same kind of thing with him. Namely, what? regard this as an aversive response, that is an attempt to get out of that situation, what you want to do is extinguish him. So you take him back to the battlefield, demonstrate to him that that negative condition, namely the negative reinforcement, does not occur, and then it extinguishes. And you could do that without knowing at all about how it came about or which behaviors it generalized from or why it was specifically this and not something else.
That's a positive part of your theory. You don't need all those details.
Any theorist will be in the same position.
Not psychoanalyst.
Psychoanalyst would go ahead and engage in his procedures without having to know how it came about. He might count on discovering in the course of his procedures, but he wouldn't have to already know in order to engage it.
I can see it following from his, trying to extinguish this behavior, but I'm not sure how, say, other theorists, why that's
Notice I slipped one over on it. My description of it did not conform to operant conditioning. I said, you show him that it's not dangerous there anymore. You can't say that in operant conditioning. All you can say is put him back in the same circumstances and extinguish the behavior by pairing the behavior, by pairing the stimulus pattern with a non-aversive additional stimulus, and it'll extinguish.
But somewhere you still got the notion that he was...
Now, Holmport would say what I said, or something like that. He said, show him it's not dangerous. All you got to do is convince him, and the symptom will go.
That still hinges on the notion that he's got that symptom because he's avoiding danger by that.
Right.
Okay. Where is that? Is that anywhere?
This is one of your descriptions of the nature of this situation and the relevant description of it.
And no theory, is providing you with any kind of...
That's right. There's no theory that will supply you with this description, and that's the operative one. What you have, if the theory provides you with a schema in which you have to plug in things of this sort. If this is the stimulus and response connection that you want to eliminate, what you do is extinguish this response to the stimulus. And there are paradigms for doing just that. Now, Hopper would say, well, if he's doing it from this appropriate motivation, then what you've got to do is show him that some other behavior is a better fit to his appropriate strivings. And you might find them both doing exactly the same thing in dealing with that client. Well, the thing that set me off is there's a particular statement in the book. They go through the analysis of the constraints that because some of these others have been negatively reinforced, they won't occur. And that given those constraints, if there's going to be danger avoidance, it's going to have to be in a way that doesn't violate those constraints. Then they say, and I quote, a paralysis of the arm or blindness satisfies these conditions. Because in most armies, a soldier is not held responsible, etc. The fact that this type of route is taken follows directly from the theory. You can see that if you're thinking of paralyzed arm, in no way does the fact that the guy's going to have a paralyzed arm follow from the theory. What type of behavior is it that follows from the theory? Anything that hasn't been sufficiently negatively conditioned. That's the type of behavior that follows from it. And what behaviors are those? Who knows? I said, if the guy didn't have a paralyzed arm, and they're exactly the same circumstances, would you then say the theory was wrong because, according to this, the fact that this route is taken almost directly from the theory? Heck no.
Again, that is there, what theories are informative?
None. That's why I'm making a big point that you don't want informative theories. Informative theories would be a handicap. What you want are informative empirical observations, non-informative theories. That's the right combination. And what you have is a bunch of non-informative theories masquerading as informative ones. This is one of the clearest statements of that masquerade. The statement that certain things follow from the theory when obviously they don't.
Okay.
Which? Any behavior that has been conditioned is generalized from one that's been conditioned and that hasn't been extinguished. But that's just giving you the formula. That's like saying, what sorts of things follow deductively? Anything such that so again, part of the message is think of these theories as schemas, not of pictures of how the world is, or how people are, or how behavior is, but simply schemas to be used by somebody, on somebody. Okay, next time let's start in on the existential theorist and think if there's any further issues concerning operant conditioning that you want to discuss.